welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 30th of November 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week in Blighty here. The mist is rolling in off the hills, across the meadows, and it's that time of year again when we're just about starting to get into winter. And we have with us today Max Musson from Western Spring to look over the news of the past week. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
A good day to you as well. Yes, I'm very well indeed. I think we're entering into a very critical part of this year, really, which is the period during which we've got these tiered levels of restrictions extending across the country instead of a full lockdown. But I think if you're in the in zone three, that's not a lot better than a full lockdown. But we're also entering a period in the run up to the end of the end of the Brexit negotiations, and so it's a critical time for us in terms of the COVID epidemic, but it's also a critical period for us in terms of the Brexit negotiations, and I think that. I think we'll all feel a lot better and a lot more certain about things. Well, I hope we will do when we get into the new year, once the Brexit negotiations are over one way or the other. And once we've found out what the availability of a vaccine will be for us against COVID-19. And once we've gone through the period to a point where these COVID-19 restrictions can be relaxed, because I think a lot of people are heading into Christmas, which is a traditionally a very expensive time of year, but they're in a situation where they are furloughed, or perhaps if they're self-employed and they're in the hospitality sector, they're unable to work, in which case they're going to be feeling very uneasy about the next few months and whether or not they are going to still have a job or still have employment at the end of that.
I think there's a lot of unrest at the moment at Boris's new tier system. We've just come out of a month long lockdown, and a lot of the places in the country that were expecting to finish this lockdown and be released from it have now been told that they're going into tier three. So in effect, the lockdown hasn't done anything at all. And Boris's response to it is, well, we'll have another lockdown. And it will last for 3 months, but we won't call it a lockdown. We'll call it tier three. We've got three parts of the country that aren't actually locked down. That's Cornwall, the Isles of Scilly, and I think there was one other place as well. The Isle of Wight. So it's about 1% of the country that isn't actually locked down on a full lockdown. And we're told this is probably going to last until March. And most of the country are up in arms about this. They're saying that there could be up to 100 Tories that are going to rebel against this when they get a vote on it on Tuesday. So Boris will be relying on the Labour Party supporting him in order to get this through. There are more and more Tories that are saying, look, this is the wrong way about going about things. Last week, there was a protest, and you're not supposed to have more than two people protesting. I think this was just two people protesting outside the Houses of Parliament, and an elderly lady was manhandled by the police, and there was a Tory MP that saw this, and he was absolutely outraged at this, and he brought it up in the Houses of Parliament. And I think we're going to see more of this. I think we're going to see more of the establishment standing up and saying, look, this has got to stop. And it's really splitting the public between one side and the other. There was another load of protests that they had at the weekend, and everybody that has been commenting on this has been saying, what is this? Is this two-tier policing? In the summer, you were getting down on one knee before Black Lives Matter rioters who were throwing things at police horses and vandalizing statues. And now you've got elderly people. I mean, these are all boomers. They're all over the age of 60 that were out protesting on Saturday, and 150 people were arrested. There were people being beaten up. Santa was arrested. I mean, that's the iconic picture that the public have seen from this, is Santa Claus being arrested by these thuggish police. I mean, that is the only way you can really describe this. And I think there is going to be more and more pushback against this, particularly in the parts of the country that have now been locked down for months on end. I mean, think about Manchester and Yorkshire. They never really had a lift. They never really had it uplifted from the first lockdown. And now they're being told they've got to go into this tier three. I guess part of it could be an attempt to pressurize people and intimidate people into going and getting the vaccine. And I have an idea about what they may be doing there, but with this, I think they're probably going to come out with a spit test, and they'll say, well, you either get the vaccine or you have to do 2 spit tests a week, and then you'll be allowed to get out and we'll be able to lift the lockdown. And I will probably go with these spit tests, but I certainly wouldn't want the toothpick through the nostrils scraping the outside of your brain test being done to me once, let alone getting that done twice a week. But that's really the sort of stage that we are at now. Max, did you see any of these protests at the weekend? Have you had any thoughts on Boris's tier system? I know you've been looking into the vaccines as well.
Well, I think as far as the tier system is concerned, it is a continuation of the overreaction. And if you look back at some of the predictions that were made by the sage people about, you know, what would happen in this country if we didn't have the lockdowns, what would happen in this country if we didn't have these tiered restrictions. And when you think that Sweden has not locked down at all, the Swedish government have advised their population to behave wisely and to wear masks when they're in public. They've asked them to do it. They haven't ordered them to do it, but they've asked them to wear masks. They've asked them to social distance and things of this sort, just to take sensible precautions, which I'm pretty sure most of the Swedish population will have done that. But they've not locked down. They've not stopped people working. But if what the sage people were saying would happen in this country was true, then virtually Sweden would be a desolate wasteland of dead and dying people by now, wouldn't it? And the fact that Sweden isn't a desolate wasteland of dead and dying people shows that the stories that were spread by Sage earlier on this year, and that they've continued to spread as we come, you know, towards the end of this year, have all been vast over-exaggerations. So in view of the fact that there's that vast over-exaggeration, I think that the policy that we've advocated all along, and that I wrote in articles in the early part of the year, where we should just have provided the facility for people who are elderly and those that have got impaired immunity to shield from the virus and let everybody else continue to work, was the right policy. Because had we done that, we would have ended up in the same position that we are in today in terms of the numbers of deaths that we've encountered, because we were told that 99.9% of the population would survive coronavirus, only 0.01% of the population would actually succumb to the virus, which means that would be 50,000 deaths or 60,000 deaths. And we're already at that sort of a level now, having had the lockdowns that have done so much damage to our economy. So had we followed the Swedish model, we would have had no more deaths, or the number of deaths that would have occurred would have been in the same order of magnitude as what we've experienced so far. But our economy would still be whole. Our economy would still be functioning. People would still have jobs, and we wouldn't be facing massive tax. And so I think that there needs to be a serious rethink on the part of the government. All of the MPs are going to be voting on Tuesday to approve or not approve the tier system that's being introduced by Boris Johnson. And what I would suggest to people is, I mean, this broadcast is going out on Saturday afternoon, evening. And so what I would suggest that people do is that they email their MP right now. As soon as this program is finished, email your MP, and you can find your MP just by Googling who is my MP, and then Googling the MP's website. And on their website, they'll have an email address. Just email your MP and just say that you don't want the lockdown or the tier system to be perpetuated, because you have got grave misgivings about the destruction and the damage that's being done to our economy. And you think that there should be a whole new rethink on the part of the government, which doesn't involve lockdowns, so that the livelihoods of our people are protected just as much as the lives of our people are protected. And get that email off to your MP, so that every MP in the country is deluged with emails, and so that when they go in to vote on Tuesday, they know that if they vote for a continuation of what's been happening and what the government have been doing, then they will be putting their own tenure as an MP under threat when there is another election.
£2 trillion pounds, I think, is how much it's actually cost so far. And it's up to 90% of the gross domestic product that we actually produce in a year is how much that they have borrowed to try and prop the economy up. And you've still got all these people that have lost their jobs. I mean, the hospitality industry has been absolutely decimated. There are people saying now that they're still going to open. They're going to ignore all of this. And we're also seeing this happening in America and in other countries. And there's been so much pressure that's actually been put on countries to do this, because if by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the Bilderberg Group, by these oligarchs basically that stand to benefit from this, groups like Amazon, Apple, others like that, Twitter, not Twitter and Facebook, but Amazon and Apple in particular have made massive amounts of money, where people have been going to them instead of going to their local stores. And the people at the top of the pyramid, they're the ones that are really directing these lockdowns. You mentioned the other week, Max, about how Lukashenko from Belarus, he'd been offered money by the IMF if he would lock the country down, and he refused to do it, and they haven't had a problem. Same with Brazil. Brazil was offered a lot of money in order to lock the country down, and they haven't done it. And now this evidence is coming out that it's only 3%, 0.3% of people that actually die of this. 99.7% of people survive, which is probably, it's similar to the flu. I think it's 99.9% with the flu. And it's very, very similar. And we've never locked down for the flu before or anything like that. Had all these suspensions of the constitution. I mean, these restrictions that we've had go right against the core of all the freedoms that we have as British people, the freedom of movement, the freedom to protest. This is what this MP was bringing up in the Houses of Parliament. He was saying, we don't seem to have really thought this through about how unconstitutional these restrictions are. And I think you could challenge some of these fines in the courts. And I think that's actually been said. The police have complained about this. What is the point in us giving these people these fines if the MPs are then going to say to them, we'll challenge it in court because it's unconstitutional? And when the police were arresting this old lady at the weekend, and the MP had a go at them, the police were saying, well, look, we are only carrying out your orders. We can only do what you tell us to do. And if you're breaking the law when you tell us to do this, how can we change it? You're the guys above us. You're above the police. You're the ones that make the laws that direct the police on how to behave. So you need to change things so that we can change things. Because, I mean, it people get very annoyed at the police, particularly at the way they treat nationalists, but it the police are really just robots, basically. They're just doing exactly what they've been told to do by the government. It is the government that is at fault, and it is government that needs to that we need to change. And the way they tell us that we do that is, as you explained there, Max, it's by putting pressure on these MPs. So if people all send loads of emails to their MPs about this, saying, pointing out that the evidence does not indicate that these lockdowns work at all, and we need to completely rethink this, then maybe this vote will get struck down on Tuesday. It's not just some Conservative MPs that are against it. There are Labour MPs that have said that they're going to vote against it as well. So it may all change yet. But then the other side of this is that they're they're going to be really pushing these vaccines. They've got a non-white person, I momentarily forget his name, that they're putting in charge of these vaccines. And I think what we will see is that they will be given to the BAMI population first, which I don't really have a problem with that. These are experimental vaccines. If they want to give them to the BAMI population, fine. The elderly, I think they should be giving them these vaccines first. And also, if there are long-term effects, then it's not going to affect the elderly because they've only got a decade left of their lives anyway. So if these effects don't start affecting people until 20 years after they've had the jab, then it's not really going to affect the elderly. So if they want to give them to, as I say, the BAMI population and the elderly, that's fine. I do think that they're going to say either you have a test or you have the vaccine. So I think they will have to come out with a reliable test, a reliable spit test. We'll have to wait and see if that happens, because the test that they have at the moment, in some cases, it's up to 90% failure rate and giving out false positives. And we can see that there must be lots of false positives because the death rate has gone right down. We've got a massive infection rate, if you look at the figures, but we've got a very low death rate. The actual graphs themselves look the opposite of how they did in March, which was a massive death rate and a very low infection rate. That is completely reversed now. And I think possibly part of that is these false positives that they're getting on the test. Elon Musk tested himself, I think, four times, and twice it said that he had the disease, and twice it said that he didn't have the disease, and that was with exactly the same test within 24 hours. So that just shows you that they're unreliable. The information they're going on is unreliable, and the effects of it is I've seen people in tears, people whose businesses have been ruined. Then you've got the elderly who can't see their families, who are near the end of their lives, and they're having the end of their lives ruined by this. There was one man in tears that was being arrested by the police at the weekend. Again, it's another iconic picture. Somebody who's had their business completely ruined, and then they exercise their right to protest about this to try and draw attention to the fact that their business has been ruined, and they end up getting manhandled and beaten by the police and arrested. There is a lot of bad feeling in the country at the moment that could manifest in civil discord, in civil strife. I think there are going to be more protests. This law that you can only have two people protesting, that goes right against the Constitution. And there are members of the establishment that are pointing this out and saying, you just can't have this. I mean, we're turning into a totalitarian, authoritarian society, again, which ties in with this Great Reset. What they want to do, apparently, is say to everybody, well, if you give over all your property, we will cancel all your debts. And I think that could be why they're trying to get the country into so much debt all around the world that they can't possibly pay it back. And then they'll have this big reset, and everybody will essentially be a slave, and everything will be digitized, and there'll be a chip which will tell you how much money you've got, and it will work like the social credit system in China, and they'll just be able to remove the ability to do business transactions from political dissidents. And I think that is eventually where all this is heading, although we may not quite get there within the next year or two. But Max, I know you were looking at the vaccines in a little bit more detail, because you were saying that there has actually been an answer to our question when we were saying that the government really need to allay people's fears and tell us how these vaccines work, because there are legitimate questions that we were asking, particularly about this RNA part of this new vaccine. Did you want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, when we spoke about this last, we were talking about how the explanation that was given for both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines tended to indicate that they were based around RNA, and RNA is a form of genetic material. And the explanations as to how this how the vaccine worked tended to indicate that the RNA was going to be was going to spread into every cell of your body. And it was, in my view, quite logical to fear that if that was the case, if we were introducing genetic material into each cell, that genetic material could interfere with the DNA, could change the DNA, and could permanently change the DNA of the person who's received that vaccine. And so the point I was making was that, people are very sceptical about eating genetically modified vegetables And yet it would appear that we're being encouraged to become genetically modified people. And I put that forward as a very real concern that we've had. And a doctor has answered that query. It was a Dr. Ellie Cannon, who wrote an article for the Daily Mail website where she sort of goes into the fears that people have. And she mentioned in there that the RNA that's used in the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines quite quickly breaks down, and so therefore and isn't incorporated into the DNA. And so I've done a bit of investigation in this particular area, and there's a website which is called PhD Foundation, and the PhD stands for Public Health Genomics. And so this is a not-for-profit organization that has been established to provide funding for research into genomics and how genetics can be used for public health purposes. And they work very closely with the university in Cambridge. And on their website, they've got some various statements there. I'll read some of these statements out to you so that you can hear what they have to say. Conventional vaccines usually contain inactivated disease-causing organisms or proteins, which is what I said was the case, made by proteins made by the pathogen, the antigens, which work by mimicking the infectious agent. They stimulate the body's immune response, so it is primed to respond more rapidly and effectively if exposed to infectious agents in the future. And so this is in accord with what we were saying, that vaccines traditionally have been based around either inactivated or dead viral material that's then been used in order to stimulate a response against the virus. RNA vaccines use a different approach that takes advantage of the process that cells use to make proteins. Cells use DNA as the template to make messenger RNA, mRNA molecules, which are then translated to build proteins. An RNA vaccine consists of an mRNA strand that codes for a disease-specific antigen. So basically, this is just a protein that is specific to that particular disease. Once the mRNA strand in the vaccine is inside the body's cells, the cells use the genetic information to produce the antigen. This antigen is then displayed on the surface, on the cell surface, where it is recognized by the immune system. Unlike a normal vaccine, RNA vaccines work by introducing an mRNA sequence, the molecule which tells the cells what to build, which is coded for a disease-specific antigen. Once produced within the body, the antigen is recognized by the immune system, preparing it to fight the real thing. RNA vaccines are faster and cheaper to produce than traditional vaccines, and a RNA-based vaccine is also safer for the patient as they're not produced using infectious elements. There is still a lot of work to be done before mRNA vaccines can become standard treatments. In the meantime, we need a better understanding of their potential side effects and more evidence of their long-term efficacy. And then also says, on the basis of safety, that RNA vaccines are not made with pathogen particles or inactivated pathogen, so are not infectious. RNA does not integrate itself into the host genome, and the RNA strand in the vaccine is degraded once the protein is made. So that last sentence particularly supports what this doctor, Ellie Cannon, says. And so I think that a significant part of my reservations with regard to taking the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine have been settled by what I've read there. It is interesting, though, and one of the things that I felt was disappointing was that when people showed genuine concerns in the way that we did, that RNA could change DNA, we were mocked in certain quarters by people who thought that we were just displaying ignorance. However, there is with some viruses such as HIV, the RNA that is produced undergoes a process of reverse transcription. Transcription is the process by which RNA is generated from DNA. Reverse transcription is where the DNA of an individual can be changed by the RNA that's been generated by the by the virus. And so it is possible with certain viruses that there can be a change to the DNA of the victim. But I'm sort of reasonably satisfied now, having read what I have, that as far as the vaccines used in order to combat COVID-19, that they will be safe on that basis, that the RNA that's produced doesn't become incorporated into the individual's DNA, but generates the proteins necessary in order to stimulate an immune response, but then breaks down over time. And the big question, I think, really, with regard to the vaccines produced for COVID-19 is more a matter of how long they last. Because if the RNA does break down, then the period during which it breaks down is likely to be the period, in my view, when the vaccine will confer immunity. And once the vaccine, once the RNA has broken down and no longer exists and it's no longer able to stimulate the production of the proteins necessary to trigger the immune response, then that immune response will start to wane. And so one of the things that we're going to need to we'll probably discover as the next year goes by in 2021 is how long that immunity is going to last for. Hopefully it will be some considerable time, and hopefully it will be long enough for us to stop the spread of the virus and to enable us to get back to normal. Because I think that the longer this process goes on, whereby the government exercises these undemocratic and unconstitutional restrictions and imposes these restrictions upon the population, then the more we as a population are going to get used to living under this kind of authoritarian domination, and the more governments are going to find that it's easy for them to exert authoritarian domination, and we will gradually cease to be a free country. And so hopefully that won't happen.
Well, that that allays some of the fears, doesn't it, that this RNA is just going to break down within the body. But how long will that take? And if it's a short length of time and then you have to have another booster injection, how much is that going to cost? And why should we need injections? Why should everybody need to have injections just to survive what's already here on the planet with us? We've had coronaviruses for years. I mean, most people, apparently, by the time they get to 50 or 60, their system has already encountered one or two coronaviruses and fought them off. And I would dare say that within another generation, we would have people that would be immune to this coronavirus as well. And you say there that she was saying that it's so much cheaper to make RNA vaccines. And if that is the case, then why is this Pfizer vaccine so expensive? Why are the RNA vaccines so much more expensive than the Russian Sputnik one? And why is the Russian Sputnik one never mentioned? It's as if it doesn't exist. I mean, that's been around for much longer than these other ones. It's been tested for much longer. The price of it is much cheaper. And yet we're being told we've got to have this Pfizer one and we've got to have this AstraZeneca one, which costs so much more. I do find that funny, the way that they just don't mention the fact that Russia actually were the first to come out with a vaccine. And Russia has said it will be the cheapest one of the lot. So why are we not using that? Why are we buying this Pfizer one, which costs an absolute fortune? I saw one bit and it was saying it was 15 times the price of the Russian
That's
one.
Right.
And yet they don't want to use it.
I think probably what will happen, though, is that the fact that the Oxford vaccine exists, that will put pressure on Pfizer to reduce their price. And what we'll probably find is that in 6 months' time, the price of these vaccines will all be pretty much of a muchness. And there won't be much of a difference. To be quite honest, the Oxford vaccine tends to work on the basis upon which vaccines have traditionally operated, which is that where you are injected with a disabled or a dead form of the virus in order to stimulate a response to the virus. And I would be perfectly happy to take that kind of a vaccine. My concern with regard to the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine was that I felt that the RNA could become a permanently incorporated into somebody's DNA, and so therefore it would genetically change the person. But from what we've I've read it and what I've shared with you today, that wouldn't appear to be the case, and so I think that we can feel more relaxed about the those two viruses. That that the big issue, though, basically, is that is the government's ham-fisted and sledgehammer to crack an egg kind of response with all these lockdowns, which are threatening to push us into a long recession, and which threatens to create a millstone in terms of the taxation that we'll be subjected to in years to come, a millstone that will be hanging around our necks for decades to come. And that's the very sad thing. And the fact that so many self-employed people, particularly those that are in the hospitality sector, will be put out of work and may well find that their industry just never recovers.
And we haven't mentioned all the people that haven't been able to get into hospital either, all the people with cancers and other diseases that have been missed because they haven't been able to see their GP. Most people now are only able to see a GP, but over the telephone or over Skype, they're not actually able to get in there to the surgery to see them in person. I think we're going to have masses of problems with cancers and other diseases from this, on top of all these businesses that have been destroyed by it. I mean, it's just an absolute catastrophe that has been made worse by the response to it. The response has caused far more damage than the virus would have done. If the virus had just been allowed to work its way through the population, if nobody had had any tests, we wouldn't have had any extra dead than we normally have. If you look at the flu figures, nobody's getting the flu. Nobody's getting the flu at all. Is that because these COVID cases, people with the flu are being mistaken for COVID cases? I mean, they're trying to say, oh, it's because everybody's wearing masks. That's why nobody's getting the flu. But if you actually look at the figures of the dead for last year and you compare them to this year, there's no actual real difference. We're still getting just the average number of the dead. And I believe in China, they've just stopped testing. They just stopped testing. If you get a respiratory illness, so long as you're under the age of 60 and you don't have comorbidities, then you're going to survive it. I wouldn't advise anybody under the age of 60 that doesn't have other underlying illnesses taking the risk with this virus. I mean, we know 99.7% of people survive this, and the 0.3% that do succumb to the illness are in the age, over the age of 70, aren't they? Once you get over the age of 80, it's I think you've got 10 times more the risk than when you're 70. But if you're under the age of 70 and you haven't got these other illnesses and you're fit and healthy, then the chances are that you're just going to fight this off. And do you really want to take the risk with this new vaccine? What is the normal risk factor with vaccines? It's bound to be more than 1%. That actually have complications, and the risk factor with the virus is 0.3% that you're going to have damage from this. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens. Wait and see what happens with the vote this week, and to see whether we see more protests and more disobedience like we have seen in other countries. Oh, I just want one other thing to bring up in Denmark. They protested against forced vaccinations and a change in the law, and they succeeded with their protests, which they were very pleased about. And that is a bit of good news that some protests did actually work in Denmark. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Max, or should we get on to our Greatest Britons?
No, I think we can get on to our Greatest Britain.
Yeah, let's get back into Florence Nightingale, who we began talking about last week. Actually, on this day in history, when we were recording this, which is on the Sunday afternoon, Florence Nightingale, aged 87, was presented with the Order of Merit by Edward VII for her work tending the wounded during the Crimean War. So we're actually very topical that we are talking about Florence Nightingale right now. Well, let's start with a recap of what we talked about last week. Florence Nightingale laid the foundation of professional nursing with the establishment of her nursing school at King's College London. She came from a wealthy family whose connections she used to push for improvements in sanitation and healthcare once she was an adult. She was a polymath, and her family could afford to give her a really good education in multiple disciplines. So she really made use of the fact that she had this above average intelligence, far above average intelligence. And during the Crimean War that she volunteered to help out at, she realized that 10 times as many soldiers were dying from disease rather than from their wounds, and she persuaded Britain to send a commission there to clean the sewers out and create a prefabricated hospital to use, and that massively reduced the death rate. And then at the end of last week, we talked about Mary Seacole, the black hostess, or a mulatto hostess. One of her parents was white and the other parent was black. And she famously met with Florence Nightingale in Crimea and wanted to volunteer to help. But Florence turned her help away as she was untrained and she had a reputation for introducing drunkenness and improper conduct among the soldiers. And we talked about last week about this memorial to Mary Seacole, which is absolutely huge. It's 4.5 metres high and it's put right outside King's College London, right outside where Florence Nightingale was. It really is an insult to Florence Nightingale to actually put this huge great memorial there. And apparently they really try to push this Mary Seacole as if she did, as if she was anywhere near as much of an influence as Florence Nightingale was. And though she may have been a good person, she wasn't really a nurse. She didn't have training. They try to portray it, the fact that she volunteered to help in the Crimea and Florence Nightingale turned her away. She didn't. It was actually a business that she wanted to set up there, the same sort of business that she had in the Caribbean, running a hotel come rest place that sold alcohol and just had ill people there, basically. I mean, it's good of her to look after ill people, but she wasn't volunteering to do this. It was a business that she was going out there to set up in the Crimea. She wasn't fully black. She was half black and half white. And they seem to have really latched on to her today. And they try to portray her role as just as important as Florence Nightingale's. And it's not. And thankfully, all the organizations that support Florence Nightingale do actually point this out. And they did try to prevent this huge, great memorial being placed outside the hospital. But they were unable to do that, unfortunately. It just is a real insult to do that to her and put that outside the hospital there. Do you want to add anything to this recap, Max? Do you remember anything else that you want to add to it?
Well, really, just on that last point, just to concur with what you were saying there, I think that that Mary Seacole would appear to have been a good woman, and she was a good business person. She knew where to site her businesses so that they would be very profitable and well received by the injured soldiers and those that were recuperating just back from the front. But the establishment that she had couldn't possibly be described as a hospital. She had no nursing training. She didn't take any part in the development of nursing training. She didn't develop the logistics of running hospitals or anything of that sort. She didn't pioneer aseptic technique as practiced by nurses today in order to treat people without spreading infection. And so, yes, it's quite right that to have this enormous memorial for her cited where it is it's really just a manifestation of the sort of extreme woke nature of our society at the moment, and the fact that the authorities are scratching around trying to find significant black people from our history that they can promote as if they are as significant as people who are towering figures like Florence Nightingale was. And so it's really silly on their part. I think when people and students of the future are asked to study Mary Seacole as if she was on a par with Florence Nightingale, then it will become screamingly apparent to the students that are undertaking those studies that they are indeed two entirely different women who had two entirely different purposes. And Mary Seacole's was to run a kind of rest home and hotel come restaurant business and general store, whereas Florence Nightingale was the pioneer in terms of creating modern nursing.
That's if they tell us the truth. I mean, they may start to credit the things Florence Nightingale did actually to Mary Seacole. The BBC have a programme on at the moment, a new series, and it's all about this great, wonderful black Briton. And you know what he did? He was the first black police officer And we've had the same with Google. They had the first black fireman, I believe, the other day as their Google Doodle. They're so desperate to find black people in our history. When they find them, they make out they did this most amazing thing. And all they actually did was get a job. He got a job as a policeman. He got a job as a fireman. You know, white people have been getting jobs as policemen and firemen for centuries, and it's nothing special. It just shows their desperation to insert people that are not indigenous to this country into our history, and to pretend that they have always been here. They haven't always been here. They've only been here for the last 70 years. Well, getting back to the Crimean War here, Florence Nightingale is well known as the Lady with the Lamp, and it was at this time that she gained that nickname. The actual phrase is from a report in the Times. Quote, "She is a ministering angel without any exaggeration in these hospitals. And as her slender form glides quietly along each corridor, every poor fellow's face softens with gratitude at the sight of her. When all the medical officers have retired for the night and silence and darkness have settled down upon those miles of prostrate sick, she may be observed alone with a little lamp in her hand, making her solitary rounds." So this shows us that she was a real hands-on nurse. She wasn't just ordering other people around. She was taking part in this, and she really must have seemed like a ministering angel. If you imagine what these soldiers had been through before Florence Nightingale went out there, they were just left to rot in lying there amongst their own waste, basically, with nobody really to take care of them. And then suddenly that changes, and you have these nurses that are going around, everything is clean, you've got fresh air, you've got somebody coming around every night to make sure that everybody is okay. You know, she really must have seemed like an angel to them, and she quite rightly was given all these awards and accolades for her charity, really, because that's what this boils down to. It's her charitable nature in combination with her intelligence and her realization of what was going on there. Well, in the Crimea, on the 29th of November 1855, the Nightingale Fund was established for the training of nurses during a public meeting to recognise Nightingale for her work in the war, and there was an outpouring of generous donations. Sidney Herbert served as Honorary Secretary of the Fund, and the Duke of Cambridge was the chairman. She would later be considered a pioneer in the concept of medical tourism as well, based on her 1856 letters describing the spas in the Ottoman Empire. She detailed the health conditions, physical descriptions, dietary information, and other vital details of all the patients that she directed there, and the treatment they received was considerably less expensive than in Switzerland. So we see here there is a fund being set up, and there's a big outpouring of generous donations. And part of that, I would probably suggest, was her family connections, because she came from this very wealthy family. So she was able to put that to use as well as all these achievements. So they set up this massive fund for the training of nurses. And besides that as well, this concept of medical tourism, I mean, this still goes on today. People go out to Bulgaria to get their teeth seen to, or they can go to Mexico for the same thing. And you know that you're going to get just as good a treatment there as you are in Britain, because it's all the same in the EU. And what she was saying here is people should go out to the Ottoman Empire. They've got the spas there. We don't have them in Britain. And also this treatment here that she was talking about in Switzerland, and this fund for the training of nurses, that was the first time that they actually had proper training of nurses. Up until that point, it had just been something that the daughter of the family that didn't have a husband or whatever, she would have to look after the dying person at home. And this is the first time you actually had training of these people to look after people in hospitals. And this was all her idea. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
Well, just really to concur with what you've been saying there, that nursing up until the point that Florence Nightingale intervened was largely an occupation taken up by, as you say, the children of the family who were girls predominantly, who became spinsters, would then look after the sick older generation as they advanced in years, but also women who became widowed and who had no other form of income and who had no other training would very often become nurses, and so it was largely an untrained occupation, and consequently wasn't recognised as a profession at all. And it was the regulation that Florence Nightingale introduced and the training that she introduced that transformed nursing into a proper profession.
Well, after she returned to Britain and began collecting evidence before the Royal Commission on the Health of the Army, she came to believe that most of the soldiers at the hospital had been killed by the poor living conditions. This experience influenced her later career, when she advocated sanitary living conditions as being of great importance. Consequently, she reduced peacetime deaths in the army as well, and turned her attention to the sanitary design of hospitals and the introduction of sanitation in working class homes. In 1860, with £45,000 that she had at her disposal from the Nightingale Fund, she set up the Nightingale Training School at St Thomas's Hospital. The first of her trained Nightingale nurses began work on the 16th of May 1865 at the Liverpool Workhouse Infirmary, now called the Florence Nightingale School of Nursing and Midwifery. The school is a part of King's College London. And what we see here is that she wasn't just helping the people in the army, she was helping the poor. This was set up in the Liverpool Workhouse Infirmary, so she did a lot of work to improve the lives of the people that were in these workhouses, to make sure that they had sanitary conditions there, and also in these working class homes. So it was for, it was the whole population that actually ended up benefiting from what she was doing here. And in 1859, she had authored Notes on Nursing, and the book served as the cornerstone of the curriculum at the Nightingale School and other nursing schools, although it was written specifically for the education of those nursing at home. So this information wasn't just given to the specialists. This book was there for the people that were working at home, as you were describing just there, Max. Nightingale wrote in this book, "Everyday sanitary knowledge, or the knowledge of nursing, or in other words, of how to put the constitution into such a state as that it will have no disease, or that it can recover from disease, takes a higher place. It is recognized as the knowledge which everyone ought to have, as distinct from medical knowledge, which only a profession can have." So she made this information available to the public, and the book itself also sold well to the general reading public and is considered a classic introduction to nursing. For the introduction to the 1974 edition, Joan Quixley of the Nightingale School of Nursing wrote, "This book was the first of its kind ever to be written. It appeared at a time when the simple rules of health were only beginning to be known, when its topics were of vital importance, not only for the well-being and recovery of patients, when hospitals were riddled with infection, and when nurses were still mainly regarded as ignorant, uneducated persons. The book has inevitably its place in the history of nursing, for it was written by the founder of modern nursing." And what I find interesting there is the book is still in print, and this is being published in 1974. So over 125 years later, the book that she wrote is still being read by the public, because the information that was in there was pretty much timeless, and still being, our homes are still based upon it today with the sanitary knowledge and that sort of information. That we need to have clean water, and we need to be able to keep things clean, we need to have fresh air. I think she actually reduced the death rate by about 20%, something like that. We'll get onto that later. But you've got any comments on her book here, Notes on Nursing, or The Nursing School, Max?
Not specifically on the book. It's just that an interesting aspect of all this is that hospitals prior to Florence Nightingale used to be more hospices than hospitals. They were places where people who were ill went to die, to be nursed during their death, basically. And this is illustrated in that the word hospital is derived from the term spittlehouse. And so hospitals used to be called spittlehouses. And so there's the area of London called Spitalfields, which is obviously sort of a field where there would perhaps have been a hospital of some sort, and this was like a reference to people going there and and coughing up disease spittle, basically, and having so that gives us a an idea of the sort of state hospitals were in prior to Florence Nightingale intervening.
Oh, I had no idea of that spittle. So yeah, particularly gross. You imagine it. There are quite a few places that are actually named after spittle, aren't they? Well, one of her signal achievements was the introduction of trained nurses into the workhouse system of Britain from the 1860s onwards. This meant that sick paupers were no longer being cared for by other able-bodied paupers, but by properly trained nursing staff. In the first half of the 19th century, nurses were usually former servants or widows who found no other job, and therefore were forced to earn their living by this work. Charles Dickens caricatured this standard of care in his 1842 published novel Martin Chuzzlewit in the figure of Sarah Gamp as being incompetent, negligent, alcoholic, and corrupt. According to Caroline Worthington, the director of the Florence Nightingale Museum, when she, Nightingale, started out, there was no such thing as nursing. The Dickens character, Sarah Gamp, who was more interested in drinking gin than looking after her patients, was only a mild exaggeration. Hospitals were places of last resort where the floors were laid with straw to soak up the blood. Florence transformed nursing when she got back from the Crimea. She had access to people in high places and she used it to get things done. She was stubborn, opinionated and forthright, but she had to be those things in order to achieve all that she did. So we see here that this idea of actually looking after the poor that were in this work, in these workhouses as well. You didn't just work them to death and if they lost their limbs, just leave them. Now they actually looked after them and they still looked after them in the workhouse themselves. Have you got any comments to make on this, Max?
Well, just that, you know, what you were saying there about Florence Nightingale's character, the fact that she sort of appears to me to be a kind of Margaret Thatcher-esque character, not in terms of her politics, but in terms of her stubbornness and opinionatedness and the way in which she felt that she had to behave in order to get things done in what was a man's world at the time.
Yeah, I think she was quite masculine, actually, in a lot of her attributes. You know, she was the exception to the rule. She wasn't really supportive of the feminists either, as we will hear later on. Well, her work also served as an inspiration for nurses during the American Civil War, with the Union government approaching her for advice in organizing field medicine. Her ideas went on to inspire the volunteer body of the United States Sanitary Commission. In the 1870s, Nightingale mentored Linda Richards, America's first trained nurse, and enabled her to return to the United States with enough training and knowledge to establish her own high-quality nursing schools. Richards went on to become a nursing pioneer in both America and Japan. And I was really surprised there. I thought the American Civil War actually took place a lot further ago than that, in the 1850s. Is that right? The American Civil War was in the 1850s, around about that time, Max? I thought it was...
It was the late 1800s.
Wow. Wow. I always imagined it was a long time further back than that. Well, she didn't just make these improvements in America. She also made improvements in India. Her attention turned to the health of the British Army in India, and she demonstrated that bad drainage, contaminated water, overcrowding and poor ventilation were causing the high death rate, and after making a comprehensive statistical study of sanitation in Indian rural life, she became a leading figure for the introduction of improved medical care and public health service for the country. In 1858, she successfully lobbied for the establishment of a royal commission into the Indian situation, and 2 years later she provided the report to the commission, which completed its own study in 1863. Following her report, which included drawings done by her cousin, artist Hilary Bonham Carter, with whom Nightingale had lived, she concluded that the health of the army and the people of India had to go hand in hand, and campaigned to improve the sanitary conditions of the country as a whole. After 10 years of her sanitary reform in 1873, she was able to report that mortality among the soldiers in India had declined from 69 deaths to just 18 per 1,000 heads. So that is, I'm not very good at maths, but that's about that's a
70% reduction, roughly.
70% reduction. Yeah, you have to help me out there, Max. But yeah, I mean, she wasn't just doing this for the army; she's doing this for the people as well. And you know, unfortunately, India still has a lot of problems with sanitation. They still have a lot of problems with sewage there. But you can just imagine what it must have been like. Because we know what it's like now. You imagine what it must have been like when she was over there 150 years ago. I mean, it must have been absolutely dreadful. And she made some huge changes, and not just for the army, but also for the Indians themselves.
The widespread also of her influence shows that she was a worldwide phenomenon, not just somebody who was famous in this country.
Yeah, unlike this Mary Seacole character. I wonder if they've ever heard of her in India. The Royal Sanitary Commission of 1868 to 1869 presented her with an opportunity to press for compulsory sanitation in private houses. She lobbied the minister responsible, James Stansfield, to strengthen the proposed public health bill into requiring the owners of existing properties to pay for the connection to mains drainage. This strengthened legislation was finally enacted in the Public Health Acts of 1874 and 1875, and at the same time, powers were devolved for enforcing the law down to the local authorities, eliminating central control by medical technocrats. Historians now believe that both drainage and devolved enforcement played a crucial role in increasing the average national life expectancy by 20 years between 1871 and the mid-1930s, during which time medical science made no impact at all on the most fatal of the epidemic diseases. So she increased the national life expectancy by 20 years by doing this. And I guess we must have just been using the equivalent of bedpans up until this point.
I think even in private residences, a lot of houses that were built in order to house the rural poor who were coming into the cities at that time, because this was the part of the Industrial Revolution where people were leaving the land and coming into the cities. They needed cheap housing, and this is when back-to-back houses were constructed, which were, you know, even more cramped and crowded than the two up and two down terrace houses that have survived to modern day times. But with these back-to-back houses, they tended to be built in squares with an internal courtyard where people would hang their washing out and things of that sort, and where there would be a kind of a wash house that people could go to there to scrub their clothes clean. But they also used to have communal toilets in these back-to-back courtyards, and the communal toilets in the early days would have not even had would have not been connected to mains drainage. They would have been what used to be called earth closets, as opposed to a water closet. So an earth closet was just basically a big box that had a lid on the top with a hole cut in it, and the earth was and so you would go and you would relieve yourself through the hole, and then you would just have it'd be a bucket full of loose earth by the side, and you would put a couple of shovelfuls of loose earth to cover over what you'd just produced, so that it wouldn't stink too much. And that's how toilets were in the 1800s. And so you know, we can see that the lack of sanitation, you know, or connection to drainage and to the sewers, etc., how that must have had a massive impact on people. You know, if you regularly, several times a day, if depending upon how regular you are, if you had to go and sit in an earth closet where you were sitting in the same sort of crude conditions that existed in the front line during the First World War, you know, where soldiers used to go and sit on a plank. And there were a notable number of deaths where soldiers slipped off the plank and fell into the excrement-filled pit behind them. And, you know, so that sort of sanitation was what passed for the norm in those days.
Well, that's one step up from, I was thinking of the bedpan, and they were just throwing the bedpan out the window into the street. I guess that must have been in the Middle Ages. But I do find it amazing to think that, what was it, 3000 BC in India, we actually had sanitation systems. White people built them. It's not Mohenjo-Daro. Trying to think of the exact name of this part of India. It was before the Aryan invasion. And we've got the remains of the city that was built there, and it has the facility for the sanitation and the sewage to pass out to these to this stream that would then take the waste away. And we had the same thing in Roman times, and it's always something that's been associated with white people is sanitation. So I do find it incredible that we made it all the way up to 1850 before we actually sorted out sanitation in London and in our cities. I do find that incredible when we had all of this in antiquity. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Well, if you go to visit Cambridge, there, I can't remember the name of the street now, but there is a large street which runs along the front of the Fitzwilliam Museum. And on either side of that street, there are the open sewers that used to exist in times of old that would have been flowing with effluent. I would imagine that most large cities would have had streets that had those kind of open sewers to begin with.
Right. And that part of India was the Lower Indus civilization is what it's actually called, with this early evidence of sanitation. Well, unfortunately, from 1857 onwards, Nightingale was intermittently bedridden and suffering from depression. A recent biography cites brucellosis, a parasitic joint and muscle pain, which is what that is. It actually comes from unpasteurized cow's milk, apparently, as a parasite that's actually within the milk. So it wasn't anything to do with her not being clean herself. It was just caught from these animals, this brucellosis. She also had associated spondylitis, which is an inflammation of the vertebrae. And they suggest that this was the cause of her being bedridden and her depression. Most authorities today accept that she suffered from a particularly extreme form of this brucellosis, the effects of which only began to lift in the early 1880s. Despite her symptoms, she remained phenomenally productive in social reform. During her bedridden years, she also did pioneering work in the field of hospital planning, and her work propagated quickly across Britain and the world, but her output slowed down considerably in her last decade. Imagine that. She's bedridden, and yet she's still working on this. She's still looking at the statistics. She's still designing hospitals. She's still writing. Absolutely incredible. She wrote very little during that final period due to blindness and declining mental abilities, although she still retained an interest in current affairs and was the recipient of more than one award. In 1883, she became the first recipient of the Royal Red Cross. In 1904, she was appointed a Lady of Grace of the Order of St. John. And in 1907, she became the first woman to be awarded the Order of Merit. And in the following year, she was given the Honorary Freedom of the City of London. And she must have been pretty much blind by the time that she was actually getting these awards and being given the Freedom of the City of London. She died peacefully in her sleep in her room at number 10 South Street, Mayfair, London, on the 13th of August 1910 at the age of 90. The offer of a burial in Westminster Abbey was declined by her relatives, and she was instead buried in the churchyard of St. Margaret's Church in East Wellow, Hampshire, near Embley Park, with a simple memorial containing just her initials and dates of birth and death. And I've missed out a little bit here as well. She's actually got some critics of feminism. But do you want to make a comment on her illness and her death here, Max?
Well, it just goes to show how determined she was, that she was prepared to work on, even though she was ill and in a condition where most people would have decided to just sit out their final years. And she was well above current retirement age, so worked into her 90s, which is a fantastic example, really, of personal productivity and the achievement drive, I suppose that's what you could call it. And so, and she obviously is somebody who is to be emulated and greatly admired.
Incredible dedication to her work there, and sort of knew that that was what she was supposed to be doing. Well, she did make some criticism of feminism. Although much of Nightingale's work improved the lot of women everywhere, Nightingale was of the opinion that women craved sympathy and were not as capable as men. She criticised early women's rights activists for decrying an alleged lack of careers for women, at the same time that lucrative medical positions, under the supervision of Nightingale and others, went perpetually unfilled. She preferred the friendship of powerful men, insisting that they had done far more than any women to help her attain her goals. Writing, "I have never found one woman who has altered her life by one iota for me or my opinions." She also referred to herself in the masculine, as, for example, a man of action and a man of business. And that's the example that these feminists should really follow, you know, changing it to a fire person, a police person. It's a fireman, it's a policeman. Man includes both male and female. It goes back to Genesis, where it says that man was created, both male and female created he them. So the word man does actually include both. And I find it interesting here that she says that women craved sympathy, and they're not as capable as men, and they aren't, they don't have the physical strength that men have. I think she would be amazed to see the way that things are today with these feminists. And it is the same today as well. She says here that she decries the fact that women aren't actually taking up these lucrative medical positions. And today we have feminists that are saying, well, we've got to have more women engineers, we've got to have more women's physics teachers, we've got to have more women scientists. But women don't want to study that. And they will never get, they can never get enough of them in there. And when they do get them in there, they end up having to lower the standards for them. So these women complain that we should be having women in all these men's positions, and that we should be inclusive and pretending that women do these jobs. But the fact of the matter is, they don't really want to do that. Most women want to fulfill their biological urge and have children. Unfortunately, a lot of them today think that they shouldn't have to get married as well. But, you know, that is basically what happens. And this idea that we should be including women in everything that men do is ridiculous. And she wasn't like that. She made great achievements for a woman, but she certainly wasn't somebody that was saying women are exactly the same as men. She knew that she was the exception to the rule. Do you want to comment on that at all, Max?
Well, just really, this is another aspect of what I described earlier on as her being sort of Thatcheresque in terms of character. Margaret Thatcher always found that it was easier to get along with men than it was to get along with women. And I think that's because Margaret Thatcher had a certain masculinity to her character in certain respects, which made her feel a greater affinity with men, despite the fact that she recognised that she was a woman and that she lived her life as a woman and you know, had children, etc. She was driven by a sort of masculine, what are normally regarded as masculine ambitions. And I think Florence Nightingale was very similar. But what I would say is that in a healthy society, there should be room for women who are more masculine in their temperament like that, and who want to go into careers. But, you know, we do have to recognise the fact that that's only going to be a minority of women that are going to be that driven and that forceful. And that, as you say, the majority of women are in competition with men, less persistent and less ambitious. And so this is why we find that in certain spheres and in certain occupations, men predominate and women are a rarity. And that's not because men I don't believe it's because men discriminate against women, because my experience of management is that men are only too pleased to have women amongst them. It sort of brightens up the day, brightens up the working environment, and so it is largely the result of the fact that lots of women don't, you know, aren't that competitive and ambitious, and it's the ambitious nature and the desire to be competitive, or the ability to and the willingness to be competitive, that drives men so that they do achieve a disproportionate number of high positions in society.
Oh, men are always driving to be the first at something, or to do something new. And these are masculine attributes. She understood that what she was showing was masculine attributes. She wasn't saying, well, all women are like this, and this is a womanly thing, is to be like this. She understood it was masculine. It was a masculine attribute. And I think you're correct there to say that Margaret Thatcher was the same. I wouldn't class Margaret Thatcher as a feminist. Well, in 1912, the International Committee of the Red Cross instituted the Florence Nightingale Medal, which is awarded every 2 years to nurses or nursing aides for outstanding service. It is the highest international distinction that a nurse can achieve, and is awarded to nurses or nursing aides for exceptional courage and devotion to the wounded, sick or disabled, or to civilian victims of a conflict or disaster, or exemplary services, or a creative and pioneering spirit in the areas of public health or nursing education. Four hospitals in Istanbul are named after her, and there are numerous museums and monuments to her, along with plays, TV series and movies. And there's a long list of attributes to her on the Wikipedia page. And these hospitals in Istanbul, of course, because that's where her hospital was set up. It was actually in what is now Turkey, when it was part of the Crimean War. So certainly somebody worthy of being included in our list of greatest of Britons here. I really wasn't aware of all these things that she did until researching this. And she is a great example of mercy, charity, dedication, pushing yourself to the absolute limits, and dedicating your life to improving the lot of your nation, and not just your nation, but all the other peoples of the world. Once again, we see somebody who was a part of the British Empire that did everything that they possibly could for the people, for the natives, once again, for the Indians. She didn't just do this for the British Army. She also massively improved the lot of the Indian population. So another great example of what it means to be British. Do you want to add any final words to that, Max?
No, I think you've summed that up very succinctly.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.